The Recipes for Life podcast is a conversation about my favourite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informed look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. If you would like to become a qualified health coach, then the Institute for Integrative Nutrition, or IIN for short, can help you achieve your goals. I completed their health coaching course many years ago, which has been one of the catalysts for my own journey into what I now love to do, which is to help people achieve greater health through the sharing of information through my books, seminars, podcasts, TV shows and films. I recommend IIN for anyone wishing to pursue a career in the health coaching and wellness space. IIN is a one-year course, so that if you're a full-time worker, busy parent, or wherever you are in your life, it is flexible enough so you'll be able to complete all the required curriculum. Please see the link included in the podcast show notes or my website to access the free sample class and first module of their program. This will give you a great taste of the format as well as the structure, and you can also utilize my special discount that I can offer you if you decide to sign up. Make sure you tell the admissions team that you're part of the Pete Evans Tuition Savings to claim your very substantial discount. Please visit integrativenutrition.com or email admissions@integrativenutrition.com. Dr. Dale Bredesen is internationally recognized as an expert in the mechanisms of neurodegenerative diseases, such as Alzheimer's disease. He is Professor of Neurology at the University of California, Los Angeles. His book, The End of Alzheimer's, The First Program to Prevent and Reverse the Cognitive Decline of Dementia, is available now. And to find out more about Dr. Dale Bredesen, visit drbredesen.com. That's drbredesen.com. Dr. Bredesen, thank you so much for being on our podcast, Recipes for Life. You have been a huge inspiration of mine for many a years. We have some mutual friends in common, such as Dr. David Perlmutter, and he sings your praises, which is pretty good company to keep, actually. And it's a joy to have you on our podcast today, because your research is at the forefront of what we can do about this devastating disease, which is Alzheimer's. So I'd like to start off. Let's actually define what Alzheimer's is, please, Dr. Dale.
Sure. And thanks very much for having me on. This is an exciting time for all of us as we're beginning to see the first people who are actually improving in Alzheimer's, something that was thought to be impossible. So first of all, Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia. It's now the third leading cause of death in the United States. And it's actually dementia overall is the number one cause of death in the United Kingdom now. It has actually surpassed both cancer and cardiovascular disease. And Alzheimer's disease hasn't really been understood. So people say, oh, you have Alzheimer's. I always tell people it's a little bit like saying, you know, your car's not working. You say, oh, this is car not working syndrome. It doesn't tell you anything about what actually causes it. So currently, it is a neuropathologist's definition. When the neuropathologist looks at your brain and sees that there are plaques and tangles, plaques that are made of a number of things, but largely this stuff called beta amyloid. It's a little sticky, a little peptide. And you have tangles, which are made largely of phospho-tau. Tau is a protein in your brain that actually is helps with keeping the ability to make long outgrowths from your cells structurally stable. So you can think about tau the way you'd think about bolts. It helps to bolt things down. So when you have those two things, then the pathologist says, oh, you had Alzheimer's disease when you were alive. And so you can see already this is a problem, because it doesn't tell you what causes it. And so people have worked hard to try to get rid of the pathology without understanding what actually causes the problem. And when I was a little boy, there was a guy who used to say, you know, I'm working on my second $1 billion. And everyone would say, wow, that's incredible. He'd say, no, actually, I gave up on the first billion because it was too hard. So I decided to work on the second one. That's a little bit like what we're doing with Alzheimer's. We've given up on figuring out what causes it. So we're just trying to cure it without understanding it, which is, as you know, a huge problem. So I've devoted my career to understanding. We've had the lab up for 30 years now, could we understand the neurodegenerative process in a fundamental enough way that we could understand what this disease is all about, and then we could begin to fashion the first effective treatments and preventions?
Well, you actually say in your book, or one of the quotes in your book is, you never change things by fighting the existing reality, but to change things, you need to build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. And then you go on to say that 99.6% of failures are in treating Alzheimer's at present. So we have the wrong model. You have brought to the fore a new model that basically replaces something that isn't working. And your model is getting results. Can you talk to us about that, please?
Absolutely. And of course, the quote is a quote from Buckminster Fuller, who said that you need to change the existing model instead of trying to go against it. And you're absolutely right. What we found is that, and unfortunately, this has been why there's been a lot of pushback. We're telling everybody else that they're wrong, unfortunately. We're saying that the way that people have been going about this, number one, not understanding what causes it. Number two, thinking it's a monotherapy sort of approach. We're going to go after a silver bullet instead of what we say a silver buckshot. You're going to get a, one simple thing that's going to do it, and that you're going to treat this without understanding. You say, well, if there is a cause, we don't know it, but we'll assume there's one cause and someday we'll find it. And we'll assume that there's going to be one good pill and someday we'll find it. Well, maybe, but so far it hasn't worked, just as you said. And what we found is that when you actually look at all of the genetics, the molecular biology, the epidemiology, the biochemistry, when you look at all these things together, you come away with a beautiful model of what this disease actually is. And what it is an imbalance in activity. You have normal activity in your brain that is making and storing memories, making synapses. We call this synaptoblastic activity. And on the other hand, you have countering activity, synaptoclastic activity, that is pulling back, that is literally about forgetting. And that's normal. You know, we're all forgetting the seventh song played on the radio on the way to work yesterday. That's normal. You're keeping most important things. And so what we found is there the molecules that power this disease at the center of it are being affected by all these different things that change this balance. And here's the big surprise. When you make those amyloid plaques, guess what? It turns out they are actually a protective response to insults to your brain that include eating the wrong food, that include not getting sleep, that include inflammation, exposure to toxins, exposure to pathogens. You are literally fighting these things by making that amyloid. So it changes completely the way we think about this disease. And now you can see why you get it. You can look at all the different contributors. You realize immediately it's not just one. You can see that there are actually subtypes, and we described the subtypes back in 2015 of this disease. And now, for the first time, you can see how to prevent it and how to reverse it.
What's fascinating about reading your book, The End of Alzheimer's, is that you're basically saying that a Western lifestyle is an Alzheimer's-inducing lifestyle. And I want to say that again because it was so profound reading that. So the way that we're living our lives in Western society is, by definition, an Alzheimer's-inducing lifestyle. Now, can you explain the core of that message, please?
Absolutely. And as you mentioned, there's actually a chapter in the book, chapter 4, that is how to give yourself Alzheimer's. So you want to give yourself Alzheimer's, you can do it. And it's important to understand that so many of these things, just as you said, we are doing already, unfortunately. So, you know, we've heard a lot about carcinogens. Everybody understands. And so, of course, Professor Bruce Ames years ago developed the Ames test. So we can test our food and beauty products and things like that for carcinogens. But nobody ever talks to you about dementigens. And in fact, they are equally important. We want to know, what are we doing each day that's actually enhancing the likelihood that we will develop dementia. And so we're doing it by having our leaky gut, by eating the wrong foods, by eating too much sugar. I mean, our bodies were simply not made to eat the quantity of simple carbohydrates that things like processed foods actually give us. If there are various viruses that we're exposed to, then if our immune system is not doing very well, again, largely because of things like chronic stress and poor diet and things like that and lack of exercise, then in fact, we are shifting that balance. You can look at this in molecular detail and see where things like estradiol fit in and see where NF-kappa B related to inflammation fits in and see where exercise and ketosis fits in a positive way. So yes, we're actually doing a lot of things, whether it's poor sleep and chronic stress. You know, so many of us staying up late at night and getting, you know, very little sleep, sleep apnea, big common contributor to cognitive decline, and by the way, also to macular degeneration, which is even more common here in the U.S. Than Alzheimer's disease. And undiagnosed, sleep apnea goes undiagnosed in 70% of people. So this is a huge problem. And unfortunately, even our doctors are not working with us to get us on the optimal programs so that we can prevent this disease. The reality is, as you alluded to, Alzheimer's disease should be a rare disease, not a common disease. And in fact, if we all did the right things, and that's actually why we started this protocol, if we all got on the right protocol, had the right evaluation, nobody should get this illness.
Well, we're going to break it down into the different topics or different ideas that you talked about here before, talking about diet, sleep, exercise, vitamin D. We'll talk about supplements as well. But I want to start off with the first and foremost, the diet. Now, in the US and also in Australia and different parts of the world, we have our dietary guidelines in place, which promote quite a substantial percentage of the recommendation is to eat grain-based products, which are in fact, high carbohydrates. Along with that, we have vegetables, we have fruits, we have meat and seafood products and eggs and different types of fats that they advise us to consume. Generally, it's a low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet, which is being touted by, in Australia, it's the Dietitians Association. So do you believe, as a leader in this field of degenerative cognitive brain health, that these dietary guidelines are a little bit out of proportion or out of balance at this particular time in history?
Yeah, and I want to be careful. You know, this is a huge field, and obviously people spend their entire careers on this. And as a neuroscientist and neurologist interested in neurodegeneration, you know, my career has not been around nutrition. And actually, of course, talking to David and others, I've learned much more about nutrition. I have to say, in medical school, we were not taught how incredibly powerful this is, how important it is. But as we've seen these people get better, we see how important the diet is and how commonly the ones who do the right thing with respect to nutrition do much better than the ones who do the wrong things. Even though, again, we were taught this was a fairly unimportant thing. And I took there was one course at my medical school on nutrition, and it was optional. You didn't have to take it to graduate from medical school. So I did take it. And what I learned in that course was that vitamin C is heat labile. That's basically the sum total of what I learned in that course. So it's unbelievable how much it has come in the last 30 years, how important this is. And it is important for neurodegeneration. So I recognize, and I think we all recognize, the optimal diet for each person can be slightly different. But as a general rule, we find that the people who do best are on mildly ketogenic diets. So you want to have a high lipid, low carbohydrate, plant-based largely diet. Yes, you can have some seafood. Yes, you know, you can have some a little bit of grass-fed beef. We tend to think of meat as a condiment. So this would be largely plant-based. Mm-hmm. And certainly Terry Walls has had very good results in multiple sclerosis with, again, a plant-based diet as well. And so we actually have people get very inexpensive ketone meters. And we want to drive them to between 0.5 millimolar and 4 millimolar beta-hydroxybutyrate, one of the critical ketones in the blood. And that includes some fasting at night, 12 hours a minimum. If you're APOE4 positive, you want to shoot for 14 to 16 hours because you are a better fat absorber. If you're APOE4 negative, you want to shoot for 12 to 14 hours because you're not quite as good of a fat absorber. And then we typically do use MCT oil as part of this. Some people actually use exogenous ketones as well. And basically, you want to have a high good fats diet. And this includes things, obviously, like nuts and seeds and avocados and all those sorts of things. So as you were alluding to earlier, yes, you know, low carbohydrate, plant-based ketogenic diet, and typically 3 hours. We call this KetoFlex 12-3 because it's ketosis. It's flexitarian. You have your choice. You want to be vegetarian? Fine. You want to have a little bit of some, you know, meat and or fish? That's fine too. And then 12 hours to 16 hours fast and 3 before bedtime. So that's the general outline.
Which is not, as you said before, the Western lifestyle that most people are living today in modern times.
Oh my gosh. So different. Yeah. If you sat down and developed the best you could do to give people Alzheimer's, you almost couldn't do better than the current Western lifestyle with respect to diet, exercise, sleep, stress, brain training, supplements, you name it. You almost couldn't do better of a way to give yourself this disease, you know, toxin exposure, et cetera.
We've discussed the food side of things in brief here, which is great because it's you're echoing so many of our previous guests on the podcast as well. We've had Dr. Terry Walls, we've had David Perlmutter, we've had Dr. McCullough on here, as well as a host of other people. And we are all speaking the same language. Have some really good fats, keep your carbohydrates down, and eat a small amount of meat or seafood if you choose to on the side, basically as a plant-based diet. But it's an anti-inflammatory approach, which I think is the key, because you talk about inflammation. Yeah. And what I'd like to understand is how that inflammation actually affects our brain, because you talk about in your book how grains, especially gluten, can have, and even dairy, can have a response on our brain's function. So can you talk to us a little bit about the inflammatory foods, please?
Absolutely. And of course, as you know, there are many different mechanisms. So things like grains and lectins and things like that can open your gut barrier, basically can make it so that you have a leaky gut and you are leaking things like lipopolysaccharide and fragments of bacteria and things like that into your bloodstream. So that's one of many mechanisms. You also have things like carbohydrates that can add non-enzymatically to various proteins. So you end up getting advanced glycation end products, and your body recognizes these as foreign. And so it actually then gives you a chronic inflammatory state. You can activate NF-kappa B, nuclear factor kappa B, which is critical part of your pro-inflammatory response. And you can trace a direct molecular pathway. NF-kappa B is a transcription factor. It enters the nucleus of your cells. It turns on hundreds of genes. And guess what? Two of the genes it turns on happen to be the ones that cleave the Alzheimer's precursor protein to produce the very amyloid that we associate with Alzheimer's. So again, the body is recognizing this pro-inflammatory state and saying, uh-oh, I'm being attacked. I better make this antimicrobial peptide. So again, you are countering an insult. And when we look at the brain, we say, oh, yeah, you had Alzheimer's disease. Well, again, you are countering this insult. So in multiple ways, inflammation leads directly to what we call Alzheimer's disease. And of course, the critical piece here is we talk about anti-inflammatories and anti-inflammatory diets and taking omega-3s and things like that. But don't forget, when you're doing that, you also want to seek the cause of the inflammation. If it is diet, great, then get on a different diet, an anti-inflammatory diet. If it is a pathogen like herpes, or if it's a pathogen like Lyme disease, then you want to make sure to include treatment of that or to enhance your immune system so that you can deal with it directly. But you want to always look upstream in all these cases to ask, what is actually causing this problem? You don't get cognitive decline for no reason.
I've read somewhere that Alzheimer's is and dementia is referred to as type 3 diabetes because of the insulin resistance factor that comes from our bodies not being able to deal with the blood sugar anymore. Is that correct or is that overreaching?
That's overly simplistic. What it says is that, yes, that's one of the contributors. And if you group the contributors, as I mentioned in the book, and as we've published also, there are four general causes or groups of contributors. So you've already alluded to the first one. What we call type 1 Alzheimer's is inflammatory or hot Alzheimer's. And this is from, as we said, pathogens and poor diet and things like that. Type 2 Alzheimer's is atrophic. So if you remove vitamin D, nutrients, you know, B12, you know, methylation factors, estradiol, progesterone, pregnenolone, free T3, testosterone, nerve growth factor, BDNF, all the things that are supporting that tremendous synaptic structure. You have nearly 1 quadrillion connections in your brain. It's remarkable. So you have to support those. And if you remove the support for those, it will downsize. That's part of a downsizing program. You literally cannot support that structure. So you use the amyloid, again, to downsize that. And that's what we call type 2. Then there's type 1.5 because it's got some of the inflammatory and some of the atrophic. And that's the one that is related to insulin resistance. So you have the inflammatory part from the glycated proteins, and you have the atrophic part from insulin resistance. Insulin, by the way, is one of the most important and powerful trophic factors for your brain cells. So when you have resistance to insulin, you are really hurting yourself in your ability of your insulin to support synaptic network. So that's type 1.5. Now, that's the one that would be like type 3 diabetes, but you can see that's not the whole story. That's part of the several different subtypes. And then type 3 is actually quite different. It often looks like a different disease, often misdiagnosed as something else before people find out, oh, wait a minute, this is Alzheimer's. It's atypical Alzheimer's. So type 3 is associated with toxin exposure. And these are people that have been exposed to things like mercury or high doses of copper. And of course, Professor Ashley Bush from Australia identified A-beta as an important binder of things like copper and zinc and divalent metals, including iron, of course. And then there are biotoxins you can be exposed to, like mycotoxins, trichothecines, ochratoxin A, things like that. And then there are organic toxins, things like DDT, things like phthalates and things like that. All of these things are things that can produce the disease. They can increase your risk. And of course, we are swimming in a sea. As Dr. Joe Pizzorno's recent book, The Toxin Solution, has pointed out, you know, we're swimming in a sea of this stuff. And again, it's not good for us. And we usually don't realize it until we have a chronic illness like Alzheimer's or like renal failure or things like that. So that is type 3. And these people often get depressed. They're often very young. We see people in their early 50s and even late 40s who have type 3 Alzheimer's. They're the ones who often present not with memory loss like the other types, but often present with executive dysfunction, difficulty with planning, or difficulty with calculation, or speaking, or reading, or visual perception. They're cortical presentations instead of your typical hippocampal memory presentation. So those are the different subtypes.
And that can be affected by mold in the house, I was reading, and different, I guess, external toxins.
Yeah. So when we first looked at this and first realized we discovered this because these were the ones who were not responding the way the other types were. And we thought, what the heck is going on here? So I started calling all the spouses and trying to understand what has actually happened. Why were these people so strikingly different? You know, different age. Most of them are female. Although not all, we have had some men with type 3 as well. They often had depression. They had the problems with the organization. They would lose their jobs very early because it was not just a memory problem at first. And what we found is that these people had this toxic exposure. And we started looking at, well, what are the toxins? The surprise was that many of them are exposed to molds and the associated mycotoxins. And people said, oh, wait a minute, what are you talking about? Everybody lives in moldy houses. Probably a third to a half of the buildings in the U.S. have mold in them. Well, many of us are not sensitive to that. But specific HLA-DRDQ subtypes are very sensitive to this. And so the reality, unfortunately, is that, yes, mold and its toxins can indeed contribute to your cognitive decline and to Alzheimer's disease.
Wow. You state that our brain is a supercomputer. So we have all this power to understand the world that we live in and for it to function and to run our bodies and to get us into a place of homeostasis. But I'm fascinated about what you mentioned at the start of this podcast is that our response to the inflammation with the plaque, for instance, in its simplest terms, is usually people say the plaque is because of the Alzheimer's or is the cause of the Alzheimer's, but you're saying that it's actually there as a protective mechanism. I want to know more about our supercomputer and how we protect it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So it is actually amazing what you have inside your skull. You have 100 billion, that's 10 to the 11th, neurons, and on average, each one has nearly 10,000 connections. So altogether, you have about 1 quadrillion or almost 1 quadrillion connections in your brain. Just an absolutely amazing computer. Now, think of it for a moment. Imagine, you're in a country and now you've got the bad guys breaching the borders. Someone is invading your country. And, you know, you've got a great, if you go back to the brain analogy, you know, you've got a great blood-brain barrier and so forth and so on. You've got all these wonderful barriers. But when those barriers are breached, what do? Well, you put down napalm. So you're trying to kill the invaders, but in so doing, you are pulling back from your borders. You are decreasing your arable soil. You are decreasing your overall global neural network. So you're making a compromise. You're saying either there's an invader invading and I've got to pull back, or I don't have enough support with nutrients, or I've got to now attack the things that are making the toxins. In all of those cases, you're putting down a material, amyloid, which is protecting you from various insults, but in so doing is also reducing your neuronal network. So to some extent, you know, we're dying of this disease as a protection for ourselves. So that, therefore, it's clear that what we want to do is to understand what we are protecting ourselves from. And we want to get rid of that insult to allow us to increase our neuronal network once again. And of course, that's one of the big issues. If you wait too long, the network is much smaller. What do we need to do? And so one of the big questions is, what can we do late in the process? Do we need to add stem cells? Do we need to add intranasal trophic factors? There are all sorts of potential strategies. These are still relatively early days. So that you can see immediately the best thing to do is to do prevention or early reversal, not wait for late reversal.
So do you believe that Alzheimer's can be preventable with the correct lifestyle from early on?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are a number of studies now, including not just our own work, but the Finger study and others that show that, in fact, there are many features. Just even when people have looked at things like omega-3s alone and vitamin D alone, these are very simple. They're really not addressing nearly all of the biology. exercise, another important factor. You mentioned earlier the diet, and so Mediterranean diet alone. So there are many things that do it. Now, the trick has been not so much the prevention, but the reversal. Once you actually have the problem, how do you reverse it? But we've seen it now. There are over 2,000 people who are on this protocol. We're actually writing up a paper right now with the next 50 who have shown, demonstrable objective improvement in their status. And doctors everywhere who practice this approach, and we've trained now over 1,000 of them from 10 different countries, including a number, of course, from Australia, New Zealand, who are practicing this approach and getting unprecedented results. Now, not everybody. We still need to understand, why is it that some people respond better than others? And there are a number of things that we have identified. But the common thing, of course, is just compliance. It's just, doing the right things, driving your metabolism, making sure you don't have toxin exposure and things like that. That typically will be the trick. For some few people, they will do all the right things and they don't respond. And we need to understand that. But in general, people respond. And we've had people even with MoCA scores, that's Montreal Cognitive Assessment, down to zero, which is late stage nursing home, who have had some response. But no surprise, the earlier, the better.
When people develop Alzheimer's, as you mentioned, it could be in their 50s, generally maybe 60s, 70s and 80s. They've lived a lifestyle, as you've mentioned, that was an Alzheimer's inducing lifestyle. So how do you, number one, you say you can either reverse it to a degree or slow down the progression of it. But how do people make those changes when they're at that stage of their disease that potentially have eaten the same way, have developed these habits over a lifetime, for them to adopt and even want to adopt a completely different way of eating, a completely different way of living? How does that change happen?
That is a great question. And this comes up all the time. Changing behavior is one of the most difficult things to do. And yet it is so absolutely critical for this and other complex chronic illnesses. And these are the things that are killing almost 100% of us today, complex chronic illnesses, not simple things like pneumonia that were killing us 100 years ago, or tuberculosis and things like that. So one thing is, we talk to people and say, look, we can't help you if you don't want to be helped. So if you really don't want to do this, this is not the old-fashioned medicine. You give me a pill, I go home. That's the last time you hear from me. That's not the way this works. This is 21st century medicine, larger data sets, more analysis, personalization, and then hooking you up with a coach or the health coach. And the health coach can work with you in between visits. And then, of course, it's tweaking. This is what we call programmatics. So we are giving you an optimal program for your genetics, your biochemistry, and your presentation. Within that program, then, we want to continue to tweak it. I mean, again, whoever said that doing one thing and just sticking with that one thing was going to be the best thing for a complex human system? That's kind of silly to think. So what you need to do today may be different than what you need to do in 3 months or 6 months. As we tweak it, as you get better and better, we continue to improve things for you. So you have an appropriate social network and family network, and we find repeatedly people who have supportive families do the best. Furthermore, as I mentioned, social networking is becoming huge, and there's a wonderful social network that's called APOE4.info, started by Julie G., a woman who is APOE4 for herself, and who actually started to have problems and had early Alzheimer's disease, has done extremely well. She's gone from her cognitive testing from 35th percentile to 98th percentile for her age. So she's done extremely well and continued. And she's, the most important of all, the most important part of all this is that once you get the improvement, it's sustained. When you give a drug, you get an improvement, you go right back downhill again because you're not getting at what's causing it. But when you actually have an optimal program and you continue to tweak it and you continue to be on it, then when you improve, you sustain your improvement because you've actually changed the underlying pathophysiology. That's the big difference. And so, yes, you're absolutely right. You need to change your behavior. And then It takes 3 to 6 months to see an improvement. This doesn't happen overnight. Remember that when you get the symptoms, the pathophysiology has been ongoing for 10 to 20 years before you're aware of this. So your brain has protected itself for a long time before you're actually feeling that downsizing. So you've got to, it takes a while to turn the ship. You know, you've got to do a lot of things. But after you get on the program, it takes 3 to 6 months, and then you want to sustain it.
Well, I have a personal question here because my wife has the APOE4 gene. She actually has two copies of it. Can you explain to us what that means and the protocol behind what she should be doing in the most basic terms? Obviously, we'll investigate more, but she's just found out in the last couple of months because her own father has Alzheimer's as well.
And you know, she has done herself such a huge favor by finding this out. So here's the status with this gene. First of all, APOE4, what this means is apolipoprotein. It's a protein. And of course, the protein comes from a specific gene, APOE. And this thing is absolutely fascinating. And I went into this in chapter 6 in the book. Just a fascinating history because this appeared with hominids. The chimps do not have APOE4. They have a chimp APOE. And with human, when the hominids appeared between 5 and 7 million years ago, they had a change. And they, as you know, fundamental change. The surprise is that the DNA of the human is not that much different from the chimp. And when I first told my wife, who's an integrative doctor, that my DNA as a whole is actually more similar to that of a male chimp than it is to her, she said, well, duh. Well, because, you know, I like ESPN, I like sports, the chimp, you know, so clearly, I do have a lot more things like a chimp perhaps than like my wife. Okay, but the bottom line is this helped us. This was a pro-inflammatory gene, and APOE is a protein that carries around lipids. So therefore, you can think of it as a fat bucket. It's like your butcher that carries around lipids. And it has a pro-inflammatory effect. And so it helped for us to, when we came down out of the trees, we walked on the savanna and we stepped on dung and punctured our feet. We ate raw meat full of microbes. We fought with each other and got cuts and scratches. We fought with our food, all the above. It helped us to have this pro-inflammatory effect. We actually lived in a more inflammatory environment than our tree-hugging or tree-living forebears, than our arboreal forebears, who actually lived in a cleaner environment. So we had to have this pro-inflammatory effect, but it's the very thing that increases our risk for Alzheimer's and for cardiovascular disease. For 96% of hominid evolution, we've all been APOE4 homozygous. It's just been within the last 220,000 years that APOE3 appeared, which is now the common one, and APOE2 just appeared 80,000 years ago. So we all have two copies. We have, it could be a 4-3 or a 3-3, things like that. Now, if you are a 4-4, your chance of developing Alzheimer's during your lifetime is between 50 and 90%. If you have a single copy, it's 30%. If you have no copies, it's about 9%. So it's not zero, but it's not nearly as high. There are 75 million Americans who have a single copy. There are 7 million Americans who have two copies. 99% of them don't know it. The reality is everybody should know it and get on a prevention program, and we could cut this disease dramatically. The global burden of dementia could be much, much lower. So when you have these, and by the way, we published a few years ago a surprising finding that when you look at this, not only does this APOE carry around lipids, but it actually enters the nucleus and binds to the promoter regions, the upstream regions of 1,700 different genes. So not only is this thing your butcher, it's also your senator. It's literally making the laws of the land. It is reprogramming your cells to be more pro-inflammatory. So if you are APOE4 negative, you're more like South Korea. You're putting your resources into recycling, into longevity and things like that. If you're ApoE4 positive, you're more like North Korea. You're putting your resources into fighting pathogens. So no surprise, if you live in a third world country, for example, if you're a Chimane Indian from Bolivia, you live longer and healthier if you're ApoE4 positive because you're fighting parasites all the time. But if you're living in a first world country, it's just the opposite. Okay, no problem. So if you know this, you simply adjust your lipid consumption, your inflammatory responses, all these things, you get on an optimal program and you don't have further problems. And you, in fact, don't have to worry about this. So it used to be said you don't want to know your ApoE status because there's nothing you can do about it. That's absolutely wrong. There is a tremendous amount you can do about it. And you can start by going on ApoE4.info, where they have over 3,000 people, and actually almost all of them are on some version of the protocol that you and I are talking about today and that we outlined in the book. So that's the story of ApoE4. And again, good for everybody to know their status.
That leads us into the Bredesen protocol. And I want you to talk about the roof with holes, because I think that really is a great analogy for people to understand how you developed your protocol and why this is so important. Because as you've said, there isn't a magic pill as yet, and there probably may never be one. Yeah. But at the moment, let's talk about your roof with holes and your protocol that you've developed, please.
Sure. And I think, you know, one day there will be certainly magic components, things that will contribute to improvement. But what we started just with the basic molecular biology of this disease. We studied amyloid precursor protein, which is the parent of the amyloid. This is a protein that's 695 amino acids long, and there are other versions of it as well, 751 and 770. And when it's cut, the little amyloid piece is only 40 to 42. There are 42 version and a 43 and 40, but it's the bad actor is mostly this A beta 42. So we wanted to understand how this actually works. And what we found is that there is a switch. You literally can go toward the making the amyloid side, or you can go toward the opposite side, which interestingly enhances your connections. So there's literally an anti Alzheimer's way for APP to be cut, and there is a pro Alzheimer's way for APP cut. And we thought, well, that's interesting. This is like a molecular switch. Okay, in a mouse, so years ago in a mouse, we could change the cutting of this and show, oh, okay, that prevents the Mautzheimer's, the mouse version of Alzheimer's. But that's a simple, simple model where you're causing it by one mutation, which is very rare in humans. So we thought, okay, well, what happens in a human, in the typical human being who has sporadic Alzheimer's, which is 95% of us who are going to get Alzheimer's? And what we found is when you follow the molecular signaling, there's a whole set of things. We thought, okay, this makes sense now. Your hormone levels, all the things that we've talked about, literally you can trace direct paths into whether this APP is going to be cleaved on the pro-Alzheimer's side or the anti-Alzheimer's side. So it's going to be cleaved on the pro-Alzheimer's side. Again, if you have microbes, it's there to help you to make the stuff that is going to kill the microbes. If you withdraw the estradiol or the testosterone or the vitamin D or the B12, you go on and on, thyroid hormone, if you withdraw those things, this is responding by saying, I'm going to help you downsize. That's the atrophic sort. So you can literally trace direct pathways from these various entities to the phenomenon we call Alzheimer's disease. So that's how we arrived at this notion. We can start to see, okay, this is why you're doing it. And this is why your body is actually doing this as a protective response. So we realized, okay, we're going to have to address all these things. And I started to tell people, I counted up about 6 years ago now, I counted up all the different mechanisms involved and came up with 36. So I said, okay, to the patients, I would say, look, you've got 36 holes in a roof here. So if you imagine you've got your roof with 36 holes, a drug is going to be a fantastic cover for one hole. but it doesn't help you that much with the disease. And again, we believe that future drugs should be tested on the background of the rest of the program. So what we want to do is patch all of the holes, or as many as we can. The good news is, the way this signaling works, when you've patched enough of these holes, the rest of them actually snap shut. And this is similar, by the way, to what was found years ago by Dean Ornish in cardiovascular disease. If you do enough things right, you literally start picking up the plaques in your arteries instead of putting them down. Same idea here. So we have 36 holes. You start now. We're going to fix your methylation. We're going to optimize your homocysteine. And by the way, one of the critical things that came out of this is you don't just want people to be at the low end of normal. You know, that's very misleading. Oh, B12 is normal. It's 300. No, that's at the low end of normal. A statistician calls this normal, but nobody would call it normal for optimal functioning of your body. So I tell the patients that we're now going to treat you like a competitive athlete. So we want to optimize your homocysteine. We want to optimize your B12. We want to optimize your various hormones. We want to minimize your inflammatory profile. We want to optimize your insulin sensitivity, so critical for this illness. We want to optimize your hemoglobin A1C and fasting glucose. These people who are doing the standard American diet, you know, walk in with fasting insulins of 15 or 20 or 30. Mm. They shouldn't be more than 5. So we want to optimize your sensitivity to insulin, and we want to minimize the sea of toxins that you're living in. Get your C4A, which tells you if you're having a biological and immunological response. We want to get that down back to normal. One of the things that's come out of this, by the way, is that Alzheimer's really is about chronic activation of the innate immune system for whatever reason, because of pathogens or because genetically you having trouble getting to the adaptive part of the immune system. Many, many different reasons, but triggering that is associated with the problem. And we therefore need to find those triggers, remove them, and then restore you to an optimal state. And so that's how this protocol works. You need to have larger data sets. You need to check the very things that doctors don't check. You need to know your hsCRP and your copper to zinc ratio and your estradiol concentration and your vitamin D and your C4A and TGF-beta-1 and MMP9. These are the very things that are telling you what's driving the illness.
That is amazing. Dale, you seem very, very calm about this in a world that, I guess, has impending doom written all over it, especially with regards to our cognitive decline at the moment. How do you stay in a state of this, I guess, this calm rationale when what you're prescribing here or what you've been able to create has the potential of changing hundreds of millions of lives, if not billions of lives? And where do you see the future of this?
Yeah, so I see, I have to say, I'm excited because we've been studying the brain and its degeneration for 30 years in the laboratory. And to be honest, I never thought during my lifetime I would be back to humans. We went, you know, 30 years ago when I was unable to make, we were all unable to treat these various neurodegenerative conditions. I decided, okay, I need to go into the lab and figure out how these things actually work. I thought I would die taking care of transgenic mice and dying cells and things like that. So to see human beings who had been hopeless getting better for the first time, it's just an absolute thrill. It really gets me up in the morning, and it's just so fantastic to see families coming together again and people back at their work. You know, we had one guy who said, I've allowed myself to talk to my grandchildren about the future once again. Another person who said, you know, I've decided not to commit suicide. It's just so great to see these things. And as you said, This is a global problem. This is a $1 trillion, you know, 100 million plus person problem. And it goes even beyond Alzheimer's. We're now starting to work on similar protocols for other neurodegenerative diseases. And I think that this is the key to looking at these complex chronic illnesses. We have to quit looking for a single cause and a single drug and realize that the drugs may work much better if they're used on the background of a program. And of course, often with the program, you don't need the drug at all. So the prevention and early reversal, that is the future. And you're absolutely right. One of the things that's come up is, as someone who's spent his life as a scientist and a clinician, I really have really had to become an activist. And, you know, obviously David Perlmutter has been through the same thing and Mark Hyman and others. But I found myself being more of an activist to say, look, we've got to do this. Otherwise, you know, as you know, Medicare will be bankrupt. This is a huge, looming and increasing problem. Back in 2011, President Barack Obama signed into law the so-called NAPA, National Alzheimer's Project Act. And so we had a group of about 50 of us that met in 2012 following that in Washington and said, okay, you know, what are we going to do about this? Well, the reality is there's now a national plan in the U.S., but it doesn't include how you're going to make it better. We sat around and said, well, what are we going to do? And so we actually, at the time, my laboratory put forth the first protocol back in 2011 which was comprehensive for Alzheimer's. And actually, the first clinical trial we proposed was in Australia, and it was rejected by both the public and private IRBs in Australia as being too complicated. They said, actually, you guys don't know how to do clinical trials because you're changing more than one variable. Clinical trials are meant to change one variable. And we said, well, wait, you guys don't understand how Alzheimer's works then, because it is more than a one variable disease. So as you alluded to, this could change the lives for hundreds of millions of people. And we would love to get it out and get people to understand that there is more with these chronic illnesses that needs to be done. You need to understand where you stand. And the reality is, we can, with what we know today, we can make Alzheimer's disease a rare disease if we do it the right way. If people get themselves checked as either prevention or early reversal, we can make this a very rare disease.
Well, thank you so much for sharing with us. And I can't wait to share this with everybody on the podcast. And I would like to finish up by, one, congratulating you and thanking you for your time today, but also just to find out a little bit more about you yourself as a father and as a human being. And I always ask my guests, what's an ingredient or two that you love to have in your own recipe for life? And whether it's meditation, self-love, play, I'd like to know what that ingredient is for you, Dale.
Well, yeah, thanks for asking. So yes, I am a father. We have two daughters who are 26 and 28 years old now. And actually, we were just together as the whole family last night. Our younger daughter is engaged to be married next year. And so, you know, if you had told me 15 years ago, that I was going to be talking about meditation and joy and laughter and things like that, you know, I would have laughed. I would have said, you know, this is silly. This is not science. But, you know, I can't ignore the data. And as you know, for example, things like a transcendental meditation have turned out to be surprisingly helpful for everything from blood pressure to neuroplasticity to reduction of cardiovascular events. So these things are, in fact, very important. And so, you know, my recipe is to stay engaged, to stay excited. If you're not excited about what you're doing, then find the thing that you are excited about doing. And I've always been excited since I was 18 years old. I read the first book on the brain. I was a freshman at the California Institute of Technology. And I read a book called The Machinery of the Brain by Dean Wooldridge. And I just got very excited about this. It was about how the brain is like a computer. And of course, there have turned out to be some differences. But the reality is that it gives you a way to look at this and to begin to approach some of these illnesses. And so I get very excited about how the brain works and ultimately about how it fails to work and what we can actually do to understand that. You know, so my sense is, look, if you're not excited about what you're doing each day, then you might be doing the wrong thing, and find the thing that turns you on, that gets you excited, because that, you know, that obviously gets you up in the morning and makes life worth living.
That is beautiful, Dale. Thank you so much. I just want to finish off by saying that we love you and we appreciate the time that you've given us today, because you are a very busy man and you have the potential, or you are changing so many lives for the better. So with that, we thank you very much.
Thanks, Pete, and thanks for all the great things you're doing, you know, reaching people. This is a huge part of this, getting out to people to do the right thing. So thanks.
Awesome, brother. Thank you so much.
The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical, or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions, or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.